roof, right?
Yeah, it took me to the roof, so I would just sit and get air. And then would carry me back downstairs there for a while. And I didn't go to school at all for, I don't know, a few months. Because I missed school.
Did they have a home program in those days?
Nothing.
What did you do? They didn't have television.
I don't remember. There was no television. Yeah. I don't remember what I did. I still wasn't well, obviously. Okay. But the interesting story is the shift of time to... This was 1927. To shift the time till 1949.
Now you've already had your graduate degrees. Okay.
I'm here in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
I have a son who's 5 years old. I come home for one night and having dinner, my son says to me, I don't want to eat. And I said, go ahead and eat, you know, I've got to eat. And he said, I don't feel well. I said, come on, that's a terrible excuse. He said, I'm sick, I don't feel well. So I went over and felt his head and he was burning. And pretty soon I said, okay. I said, anything else? He said, yeah, I have a pain in my chest.
Oh my gosh.
Here. And points to the where the apical surface of the lung is. So he has a fever, take his temperature, he has like 104. And he's got these terrible pains in his chest. And I thought, this is it. He's got pneumococcal pneumonia. That's a typical sign. I have a pain in this particular area. It's the onset. Hurts when he breathes, got pain here. So I called somebody. I hadn't been in Pittsburgh very long, and I had met somebody named Stuart Stevenson, who was a professor of pediatrics. I had somehow had lunch with him with Jonas Salk. And so I called Stuart Stevenson, I told him what the problem was, and he said, well, I'll give you the name of the pediatricians. And you, I said, we don't have a doctor, can you come? He said, no, I can't come now, but I'll give you the name of two people who just finished a residency program who are really good. And either one of them, you can pick either one of them, could give them a call, give you the telephone number, and he gave me two names, Bernie Michaels and Lee Bass. Mm. And so for some reason, not with no particular reason, I called, maybe I wrote it down first, I called Bernie Michaels. And he answered the phone. I called him at home. He answered the phone. I told him what the symptoms were. And he said, I'll be right over. And he came to the house. He examined my son. And he gave him a million units of penicillin.
And he's better.
In a couple of hours. And it was such a dramatic, for me, it was such a, and the diagnosis was correct. I mean, they never did cultures to confirm it, but the clinical symptoms were just perfect. And it's really a dramatization of what a difference antibiotics make in health of kids.
Well, you hear that all the time, sure.
And, you know, my experience and his experience were just symbols of what happened to infectious disease research. Anyway, that's the pneumonia story for today.
Can we go back to Ann Arbor?
Yeah.
Okay, so you got a master's degree
in
1941. You had mentioned in the first tape that you married very early in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. Was that at this time or later? You also got your doctor of science from...
Just before I got my doctor of science degree.
I see, okay.
It was 1943 I got married. I got my degree in 44.
Okay. Any memorable experiences during this time?
I just loved it. I just had a marvelous time there. I just had just a good experience in Ann Arbor. I liked Ann Arbor very much, and I had made a lot of good friends that I have to this day. And it just was a very formative experience.
Was Ann Arbor as cutting edge at that time as it was later? I mean, social policies or what?
No. Ann Arbor at that time was a sleepy college town. I mean, at that time there were only 18,000 students in Ann Arbor.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh my.
It was compared to today, it was a tiny little place. So it was manageable. It was manageable. And it wasn't the big industry it is today. It's completely changed. And the town was a college town. It was a really small college town. It wasn't what Ann Arbor is today. It's just a big industry, the university. And it was the medical school was well thought of, and the law school, and it was considered a really good university, but it wasn't the size of it today.
Did you have any mentors in your graduate program?
I had a mentor, yeah.
Your advisor?
My advisor, yeah.
Who was that?
A man named Walter Nungester.
Oh, I know that.
Nungester.
Was Dr. Tommy Francis there at that time in the School of Public Health?
I think while I was there, they established the School of Public Health, and he came around 1941.
Did you know him?
I didn't know him when I was there.
Okay.
Yeah. Later on, I knew him very well.
Okay. The reason I lived in Ann Arbor, that's important for the tape, so I'm familiar with it. Okay, so you got your Doctor of Science in 1944, and what happened then?
Well, the next
you were in the Army.
Then I went to the Army.
Right from
from Ann Arbor.
From Ann Arbor. And it was still wartime.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You want to tell us about that? In what capacity did you go?
Well, I had been deferred because I was teaching medical students. And there was a special speed-up program for teaching medical students. And so I was teaching medical students who were all in the Army, because the Army had an intense program, and enrollment was almost double the physician enrollment. And so I was teaching medical students. I had a deferment, and then I was deferred also because I was married. And then the manpower problem got bad, and I realized that I was going to be drafted. Sooner or later, I was going to be drafted. So I applied for a commission in the Navy. And in the Navy Medical Corps. And they had an opening for somebody who could work on malaria control. And so I applied for that program, and I went through all of the physical exams and tests and everything else in Detroit. Went to Detroit, the Naval Station in Detroit. And they had to send this to Washington, and it had to be approved and come back. And in the meantime, I got a draft notice from my draft board in New York, because my address was still in New York. And despite efforts to say, well, can we wait till the Navy makes a decision, they wouldn't wait. So because a draft notice supplants any other arrangements you make, and I don't know what. There's nothing I could do, and so I was drafted into the Army.
Okay, and where did you spend your as a private?
Mm-hmm.
Could you use your skills?
Well, I was inducted into the Army in went to Fort Sheridan, Illinois, outside of Chicago, and then from there, I was sent to Camp Barkley in Texas, and took infantry training there. And when I was through with my 8 weeks of infantry training, everybody was shipped out, and the story was that there was 100 men in the company that I trained with. And this was about the time of the Battle of the Bulge. This was 1944. And they needed manpower very badly, so they shipped these people out. And supposedly they were going to the Battle of the Bulge, and they called, out on a company street, they called 99 names, they never called mine.
Okay.
And so everybody gets into trucks and goes away, and I'm standing there, and I go up to the sergeant, whoever it was the sergeant that had the roster, and I said, you missed my name. He looked again, and he said, your name wasn't on it. I said, what do I do? He said, I don't know. And so I stayed, I think it was for 2 days, in this deserted company area, because another training group hadn't come in yet. And I just stayed there all alone and would go to other training areas to get my meals and just get online with meal time. And just stay there. And then I would walk to the company, to the camp headquarters, which was miles away. There was no transportation. I'd walk, I don't know, it was a couple of miles. And I remember walking there and going to them saying, I'm in company so-and-so, in training area so-and-so, and everybody left and I'm there all alone. And they'd say, what's your name? And I'd give them my name, and they'd come back and say, just say this, somebody had to come and get you. Then one day I was called to the headquarters, and some major interviewed me, and he wanted to know what I knew, who I knew. And I couldn't understand what he was talking about. I mean, he was asking me questions that I couldn't understand what he was getting at. It turns out that my professor, Walter Nungester, had gone to work at Fort Detrick in Maryland and was working on bacteriological warfare. And knowing that I had been drafted, he put in a request that I be transferred to Fort Detrick in Maryland. Because then I could work on what I was trained to do. And I never knew this, but this major obviously knew that these things weren't identified. Fort Detrick, nobody knew what was there. It was, probably had a code name of some kind. And he was trying to find out from me if I knew what it was.
Oh, I see.
See, he thought I knew.
I see.
So it turns out he was trying to find out, and I didn't even know. I didn't know.
I don't think anyone did.
Well, I didn't even know that they had put it. I'm telling you now, post facto, that I didn't know what the deal was. I didn't know that I had been requested. That I had been, my name had been put into this high priority request. But I knew something was happening, but I had no idea what it was. And one day, somebody came in a jeep to this area after two or three days of this waiting to hear, and handed me some orders and said, somebody's going to come by and pick you up at such a time and going to take you to the railroad station, and here are your orders. And don't open them until you get on this, such an outside observer name, the number of the train, and the time would be in Abilene, Texas. They wrote me Abilene, Texas, and I got on the platform, and I got on this train and opened this thing, this envelope, and it said, these are sealed orders, you're not to open, and you show this to the MPs, any MPs that stop you, you just show me sealed orders, and it said on the envelope, you go to, and there was a ticket in there to a place called Nashville, and then, pardon me, Knoxville, Tennessee. And then it said, proceed to Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And when you get to Knoxville, call this telephone number.
Sounds like a movie.
So I got on this train, and all the soldiers and even the officers that were on the train, I said to them, what army base is at Knoxville? They didn't know any. What about Oak Ridge? Never heard of Oak Ridge. So it was a big mystery to me. And so this took almost over a day trip to get to Knoxville. Got to Knoxville, but had to change trains in Memphis. Something like that. And got to Knoxville, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I got off the train with my duffel bag and went into the station, which was deserted, and went to a phone booth and called this number. And somebody says, hello? And I said, hello. And I told them who I was, and they said, well, where are you? And I said, I'm at the railroad station. And they said, just wait there. Somebody will come and get you. And so I lay down, put my head on my duffel bag, and went to sleep on the bench. And I don't know how much longer, somebody wakes me up, and there's this man standing there in a lumber jacket. And he said, are you Private Younger? And I said, yes. He said, come with me. And I said, where are we going? And he said, let's see. And we got in a car, unmarked car, and drove out into the mountains. And he wouldn't answer any questions. And pretty soon I could see that there was light. The sky was lit up ahead. And he said, "That's Oak Ridge." And I said, "What's at Oak Ridge?" And he said, "You'll find out." And we got to Oak Ridge. It was middle of the night. And they go through a guard post. And they took my picture and they fingerprinted me, and it scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And I didn't know where I was. And it was very unusual. And then he drove me to a barracks, and he said, "There's a bed in there, an empty bed, go in and go to sleep. And they'll get you in the morning." So I went into this thing, and I could hear these men sleep. It was pitch black inside the barracks. And I had to go down the line, feeling each bed to see which one was empty. Of course, I'd put my hands on faces, and people would rumble and yell at me. And I finally found an empty bed, and I was so scared I didn't get undressed. I just took off my shoes and laid in my uniform, covered myself with a blanket, and just waited to see what would happen. In the morning, of course, I woke up, there were all these men and the soldiers in the barracks, and we were at a place called Oak Ridge. And there was a briefing I got from somebody called me to a hut where there's an office, and this officer briefed me and maybe one or two other men who had come in the day before, and told us that this was Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It's called Manhattan Project, and we're working on something that's very important in winning the war, and if the Germans got it first, then they would win the war. And it was some kind of new thing that we wouldn't, But that secrecy was very important, and we learned to contact anybody right away and tell them where we were, because we couldn't do that till we went through security clearance. So we were in Oak Ridge till we cleared security, and then we would be assigned somewhere.
Who's we?
The enlisted men. There were maybe 30 enlisted men in that barracks who were waiting for reassignment.
I see.
Because they had installations all over the country. Didn't know where they were, and didn't know anything about them.
So they were all in your possession?
They were all in my position.
Yeah.
Nobody knew what was going on. Nobody talked to one another. Nobody didn't talk about them. Because they really emphasized security. And so you're afraid to talk to anybody. And you didn't ask. Because they didn't know. So I think I spent a couple of weeks there, maybe a week and a half there. In the meantime, they were going, I know that they made inquiries all over, because my mother was frightened to death when the superintendent of the apartment house on West End Avenue saw her and told her that the FBI had been there asking about me. And she was sure that I was in trouble, because she was also sure I was a communist, because I subscribed to PM. My family was very conservative politically. And there was a newspaper called PM, which published for a while.
PM?
PM. It was an afternoon newspaper published by a guy named Ralph Ingersoll, was the editor. And it was a liberal paper. Well, she considered this a left-wing paper, and was sure that I was in some kind of political trouble in the office. So I disappeared. I mean, she wasn't getting letters from me. So my poor mother was convinced I was in bad trouble. But I obviously cleared, despite what my mother thought, the army cleared me. And we went through the same thing again. I was told that now I would be reassigned, and I passed security clearance, and now I could be reassigned, and tomorrow I was going to get my orders. And again, they were sealed orders. And I got on a train in Knoxville, opened the orders, and I was going to Rochester, New York. And again, call a number when you get there. Just a telephone number. So I got to Rochester, New York, again in the middle of the night, and they had an amazing snowstorm. It's interesting that when I passed clearance, my wife was allowed to come and visit me.
In Oak Ridge?
In Oak Ridge. And they had a guest house. And she came to see me for the weekend. She was just going to be there for the weekend. And when I got my orders, the officer in charge said, I'm not supposed to do this. But if I were your wife, where's your wife going to go? And I said, well, she's going back to Detroit with her family. He said, do you want her to go with you? And I said, I don't know. He said, well, I can't tell you where you're going. But if I were your wife, I would buy a ticket to Rochester, New York. So he was very nice. So she went to Rochester with me. We arrived in the middle of the night, and it was just this gigantic snowstorm. Hard to get a cab or anything. The hotel rooms, couldn't find a hotel room. And, we finally got in a hotel room, and we knew somebody who was at the University of Rochester that had been a graduate student in psychology, was now on the faculty there. And so the next morning I called him, and we moved into his apartment while we looked for a place for me to live. And then I reported to what turned out to be the medical school, had a project going on here, which dealt mostly with rabbits and beagle dogs, and they were giving them inhaling something which was called capital T. It was called T, and nobody knew what there were about 8 or 9 enlisted men there. There was a few officers, the rest was civilians. And it was an installation. It turned out that tea was uranium and uranium salts. And this was a medical control division that was monitoring toxic levels of inhaled uranium ores, uranium salts. Because the workers in the plants were occupational safety. Because what they were looking at, how much uranium salts could be inhaled by these animals before they show toxicity in their kidneys and other organs. And so it was quite a while before I found out what T was. I finally figured it out before they dropped the bomb, but by being in somebody's, you weren't supposed to ask, or GIs weren't supposed to talk about it. And nobody would tell me if they did know. But one day I was waiting to talk to somebody who was a civilian scientist in his office. He told me to sit there and wait for him. He did something else. And I was sitting opposite his desk, and there were a bunch of books from the medical library, bound volumes, on the desk. And these aren't secret. These are bound volumes from the library. And so I noticed that everybody had a marker in it. So I just started at the top and opened at the markers and looked at the paper. It was marking, and every one of them right down was the toxicity of uranium salts.
But if you were doing
I knew it was uranium that was T. I figured that out. But then, when I got to know the other GIs a little better, we used to talk not about uranium, but I knew enough physics to know about fission and energy. And when we talked in the quiet of the outdoors about these things, we used to speculate on what it is that some of they're working on somewhere else. And it always was a propellant. Because by this time the Germans were sending the V-2 rockets into England, and also there were jet planes, which were new jets, and the V-2 rockets, which were jet propelled. And so we figured this is a propellant. And there were real problems with that because of the shielding it would need, but we figured they had figured something out. But we never, never dreamed of this bomb. That didn't occur to me until the day the bomb was struck. That it was a bomb. I knew it was from the energy. But that this would be a bomb. never crossed my mind. Because if we did talk about it, it was too horrible to contemplate. Just think about it. Because, you know, because at that time, when you thought about that, you thought of a chain reaction. This is what everybody's afraid of. Once you start this reaction, maybe it would never stop. But. So it was a real revelation when it turned out to be a bomb. It was a revelation to me, as well as to most other people who weren't associated with the production. Because we had nothing to do with any of scientists or any other installation.
You found out about the bomb just like we did. Both times, I mean, the two times, the two different
Well, of course, the first time. The first time is important.
And you didn't know what was going to happen a couple days later?
Oh, no. Didn't know we were completely isolated from the rest of the project. They're out there in Rochester. There are only about 100 people at this lab, and only maybe a dozen and a half of military, a few officers, and mostly enlisted.
But your enlisted colleagues also, I assume, that they also have training in laboratory work as you did?
Most of them had some kind of either chemistry majors and so forth. I was the only one that had a PhD.
And you did routine kind of?
I like pathology.
I see.
Did pathology.
I see.
Was there any motivation in this that could be helped to the survivors or what? Was that that there would be ultimately some way that if there were survivors?
Never thought. Survivors of the bomb?
Yeah.
This was not a problem that we considered.
You didn't know until after.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant, do you think?
But I stayed on the project for some time. They didn't just discharge everybody right after the bomb was dropped. In fact, they waited quite a while before they discharged everybody.
How long?
I wasn't discharged until sometime in 45 or 46.
And then you were discharged from the Army?
Yeah.
That was your last post?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have anything else to tell us about your...
About my stay there?
Yeah.
Well, probably, looking back on it now, probably got one of the early samples of plutonium to test for toxicity, and they never told us what it was or how dangerous it was, and what they did was to tell us it was something that was highly dangerous, and since they gave us these lead aprons to wear when we worked with it, I figured it was highly radioactive, and we had to inject rats, and there was a special room set aside for the rats that got this, and all the urine was collected, and the sawdust to see the excretion rates, and when they died, we had to not only inoculate the rats, but we had to autopsy them when they were dead and look at the tissues. And it's interesting looking back on it now that the only ones who were allowed in that room, the civilians, animal handlers, weren't allowed in. It was just the GIs, the enlisted men, who did all of the work, including cleaning the cages and changing the bedding and the animals and everything. And it's because somebody knew how dangerous it was. And I guess in that setup, the GIs were the expendable. And it's often occurred to me, and the reason I was extremely wary of this whole thing, and I've always said that one of the reasons I probably didn't get exposed to anything dangerous is because I had learned aseptic technique. That is, I treated it like it was plague or something that could kill you.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, was very, very careful about breathing. Gloves, and was very careful how I took them off. And I was extremely treated like it was a highly infectious agent, but probably that was helpful because the conditions were primitive.
The others did not take such
precautions. I didn't work with anybody.
There were no instructions as far as
just to be careful.
Of course,
wear gloves and wear this wet apron and so forth. But we didn't have to change our clothes when we left. I mean, it was today, you know, what would happen, we would go through a room and put on special disposable clothes, and we would go in and work, and we would mask, and foot in, and then you would come out and dispose of the clothing, and shower, and put back on your clothes through an airlock and so forth to do what you did then. And sometime, you know, if I only remember the name of all the men who worked there, but I'm sure sometime when I have time, with the Freedom of Information Act, I might be able to get the names of the people who were assigned to that project and find out what happened.
Was your wife living in Rochester the whole time?
Most of the time. Most of the time. But then she went back to Detroit and we found an apartment, and then she brought my son to Rochester. To live in Rochester.
Okay. And when you were discharged from the Army, you went back to University of
Michigan? Yeah, I was an instructor, and it was understood that I had a year to find another job.
Within the university or anywhere?
Anywhere.
Okay.
No, there was no possibility of staying. Okay.
And microbiology still was in medical school at that time?
Mm-hmm.
And then you did find a job at the National Cancer Institute.
That's right. And what I heard about was a new program they were starting in the public health service. They have, you know, the public health service has a commission corps. Which is a quasi-military service. And in time of war, they're part of the Navy, the public health service, by tradition. Because they used to, it was originally started for treating, well, supervising the health of emerging Marine public health service.